First, I'll just very quickly recap what SSH was and what public key authentication was, and then go to the real substance. I assume almost all of you know what they are, but just to remind. So it's for system administration, file transfers, tunneling, encryption, secure authentication, ships with every Unix and Linux distribution by default. It's extremely widely used also for router management, firewall management, on all layers of the networking stack, from managing networks to managing virtualization, especially provisioning within larger virtualization systems, managing the operating systems, file transfers on the application level, even things like hardware management ports like IPMI often support SSH. I've seen it in copiers, printers, all sorts of things. It's widely used for automation. So even most people think of it as interactive usage, system administration. I'm sure that almost all of you are familiar with that use case. But much more than we think is actually automation. People who have built scripts, hundreds of scripts, thousands of scripts, tens of thousands of scripts in larger organizations that run daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, do something on another system, transfer data, execute a configuration change, reconfigure systems to use the disaster recovery site, do verify licenses, respond to emergencies, whatever. If you need to do automation, the best practice has been to use SSH and specifically public key authentication for that. Lots of implementations, OpenSSH, TechTIA-SSH, many others being used in different enterprises and different platforms. Now, public key authentication uses digital signatures by a private key held on the client side to authenticate to the server. And the server is configured with the public key in an authorized keys file, typically in the user's home directory. And possession of the private key then authorizes access into that account. It can be configured with restrictions so that it can only be used to run a certain predefined command, for instance, or that it can be used from only predefined IP addresses. Most people, however, haven't actually used those restrictions. So in most cases, the key provides shell access to an account in the operating system. In a lot of cases, to privileged accounts, system accounts, service accounts. Most keys that actually exist in enterprises are without passphrase. When people use them for interactive access, when sysadmin uses it for single sign-on, they usually use a passphrase. But when it's used for automation, passphrases are normally not used because it's cumbersome, and if you have to put a passphrase in a script anyway, it doesn't really add security. And people have been configuring these keys for years. Reality has been that they are almost never removed, and most organizations haven't really documented them. And when you add a key, it's basically run SSH ask pass to create a key pair, run SSH copy ID to copy the public key to a server and install it in the authorized keys file, and you are done. It's so easy to take it into use. So whenever needed, sysadmins have been doing this and adding keys. No central control. And just to illustrate, on the client machine, there's a client application running on some account using the private key, connecting to the SSH daemon on the server, logging into some target account that has the authorized keys file configured. Now, these keys create trust between accounts. If you get to the client account, you will also be able to get to the target account on the server without further authentication. So essentially, the target server trusts the client machine. If you get root on the client machine, you'll be able to read any private key stored on that machine. The server trusts the client machine. Anybody who gains at least root access or access to the account holding the private key will get access to the target server. Now, these trust relationships can be dangerous. Let's assume you break into this machine. Where can you get? Well, if this machine trusts that, or when that machine trusts that, and you basically can transitively use the keys to move to different machines. Especially if you use other attack vectors to escalate privileges once inside a machine. And we all know that it's much easier to gain root access once you are already inside the machine. There have been quite a few vulnerabilities that allow that. It's much, much harder to do it from the outside. And what does your trust graph look like in your organization? Do you know? Most people don't know. Most people haven't got a clue. Do you even know how many authorized keys do you have on your servers? Any idea? How many zeros? Order of magnitude? Some examples. In a global top 10 bank, over 1.5 million keys. This morning, I just heard of a bank, a top 10 bank in the US. They'd just finished scan. It was about 2.5 times this much, with 750,000 distinct keepers, 20,000 granting root access, distinct keepers. This particular bank has over 2 million daily key-based logins into just a subset of 2,000 core production servers out of the 30,000 servers. We don't yet know the total number across the entire infrastructure. Nobody in that bank knew who can access what servers or what data in reality. Of course, they kind of thought they knew. Of course, they kind of thought they had all their 100,000 plus users under control in AD, in other repositories, and access to production servers was tightly controlled until the auditors caught up with it. Other things, 400,000 authorized keys from one bank. Probably over 1 million keys, a top 10 bank. This actually was the one that turned out to have about 5 times that much when they finally did the scan. From a top credit card company, we were all stunned by the number of keys found. I don't know how many they found. Presumably quite a few. It's turning out that sometimes more than 90% of all access credentials for production servers are actually SSH keys. Let's say this bank with 100,000 plus users, 100,000 plus passwords, and on top of that, 1.5 million plus SSH keys. That is more than 90% of the access credentials being SSH keys. Many of those granting access to production servers, about 10% of those keys granting privileged access to some kind of privileged account. And if you think of 2 million daily key-based logins into those production servers. I don't know the number of interactive logins to those servers, but my guess is that this is way over 90% of all operating system level logins to those servers. I'm not counting application access because that's the kind of not operating system level credentials. It's clear that we cannot ignore 90% of access credentials for servers or 90% of actual logins and pretend they don't exist. There are still many organizations who pretend they don't exist because they haven't yet been flagged by auditors. Many people don't have visibility into this issue. These keys have been in the sysadmin domain. Most sysadmins only see a small corner of the whole IT environment. And management, in most cases, hasn't given priority to this, hasn't really understood the scope of the problem or the risks, hasn't really put efforts into finding out what they have. And this has really come to the surface in the last year or two. common examples of trust from development and test systems into production. This was one of the things that the bank I mentioned failed audits on. It's pretty clear that these are generally not protected to the same level as production systems. Normally, you require privileged access management and all sorts of policies to be followed to access production systems. Well, the keys actually bypass your privileged access management systems. What enforces admins to use privileged access management systems? Well, things like changing the password every 20 minutes on the servers. Well, do these keys rely on the passwords? No. Once you've once gotten access to the server, you can install a key, and many people actually do that for convenience. They log into the database admins log into the database account using keys because it's more convenient than going to the GUI provided by the privileged access management system. They can more easily transfer files and scripts to the server. New patches, new distributions. For convenience, a lot of people do that. And so bypassing the controls is one problem. At one customer, they had this kind of access for copying data from production into test systems so that they could test things with real data. One time they copied the data in the wrong direction. Oops. It's not just malicious activity. These are prone to mistakes as well. Another common thing, from personal account to application account, like the database admin for convenience, or to root account for convenience. And these seem to be fairly common. Another thing, a low-impact system, like in the US government, for instance, classifies systems based on impact of breach at that system. Well, do you have access, automatic access from low-impact systems into high-impact systems? If you can log in into the high-impact system without further authentication, of course, the high-impact system is fully impacted by that low-impact system, and actually it is a high-impact system. Many people have machines outside a PCI environment for credit card processing that can log into the PCI environment without password, especially with PCI 3.0 that's coming out, I think, next week or this week, around now. They are very clear that anything that has a security impact on cardholder data on the PCI environment is within scope of PCI audits and PCI environment. If you have a machine that can log into a machine with access to cardholder data without password, it's pretty clear it has a security impact. And this is something many auditors haven't understood to ask for. We are trying to educate them. An external vendor, let's say a sysadmin contractor or outsourcing partner, might have access to your systems, set up keys for convenience, for file transfers. Are those keys removed when the contract is terminated? Now, of course, you have some extra protections for external access by firewalls, etc. But it's also pretty easy to have a script that logs into your, let's say, home machine and uses port forwarding to provide backwards access. I know people who do that for convenience because the employer doesn't allow them to access from home, so they log in from work to their home machine and leave port forwarding backwards so that they can get in from their home. Some nastier examples. If I was the NSA, the Chinese, the Russians, the mafia, and I wanted to leave backdoor access into a company's systems, what's a better way to hide a backdoor than to install an authorized key? If the organization doesn't know what authorized keys they have, how many they have, What order of magnitude in numbers do they have? If you add one, what are the odds of that key being discovered, that it's not legitimate? Even if it is discovered, if they've got a million keys and no records why each key is there and who installed it and when, how are they going to tell that it was used for an attack rather than some, let's say, unapproved but possibly not so dangerous purpose? That would be my preferred way of hiding backdoor into a system. Ex-sysadmin, let's say, is let go on bad terms. How do you make sure the person doesn't have copies of keys? These are small enough that you could actually literally write them on the back of your hand. It's a few lines of gibberish. Or certainly print it on paper and type it in. It's possible, it's a little painful, but it's totally doable. I know people have done it. Or if you think of attacking an enterprise, let's say you have 1 million, 5 million, even 100,000 authorized keys in your IT environment, several per server. What are the odds that you can spread the attack if you get into one server? Maybe a few keys leading to a few other servers. Then from each of those servers, a few keys to other places. The odds are pretty good that once you get to one server, you can break into other servers throughout the environment. Maybe not every server, but possibly 90% of them. And these keys are used for things like backups, configuring disaster recovery sites, cluster configuration, copying data to disaster recovery sites. What are the odds that the attack is able to spread to your disaster recovery sites, backup systems, etc.? If it's really nasty and it uses other vectors to escalate privileges to root, let's say you recognize the top 5 tape robot vendors and database vendors and so on and start wiping data, say take each tape in turn and overwrite the first 10 megabytes and then reprogram the boot flash and reprogram the firmware on your disk drives. How long does it take to recover if that affects, say, 90% of the servers, including disaster recovery sites? It can, of course, also be used by advanced hackers for furthering the attack once inside an organization. Some problems, not knowing who can access what. Information security starts from knowing and controlling who can access what. Bypassing privilege access management, backdoors by whomever. They are essentially permanent if these keys are not managed, not rotated, never removed. Most organizations are too scared to remove them because they don't know what would break, because some of these keys are absolutely business critical. If these are used for file transfers with business partners, forget to put in a command restriction and suddenly you may allow command line access from outside, accidentally. Development to production, low impact to high impact, non-PCI to PCI. Lacking effective termination of access when an employee leaves. Now that's required by most of the security standards for compliance affected organizations. You must control who can access what, and you must terminate access when the need for access is no longer there, or when an employee leaves or changes roles. Quick attack spread once inside. It could be an existential threat for an enterprise. It could destroy an enterprise, bring it down for months. Many organizations cannot practically change their keys even after a breach if they don't know which servers have some key authorized. Of course, if they go through enough trouble, they may over time. But if they don't have centralized access to all servers, no records of the keys, it can be extremely difficult. And of course, lack of compliance with PCI, FISMA, Sarbanes-Oxley, FERC-NERC, HIPAA, all these require knowing who can access what and proper termination of access. And some of them require auditing privilege access, etc. Configuration management rules may require this, like in FISMA or 853, etc. I've been working with NIST on a NIST IR document that's coming out very soon. FISMA and 853 basically require managing SSH keys and SSH-based access in like 20 different ways. It doesn't really mention SSH keys in this sense, but it's very clear in many of the requirements. There's an ITF draft available that provides deeper information. It's not really a standard or requirement, but it's the largest guidelines available right now. PCI 3.0 requires this in a number of ways, the scoping issue and a number of other rules there as well. Again, the standard doesn't really mention SSH in this context, but it's clear when you read the requirements that you have to have this under control to comply. Monetary Authority of Singapore Technology Risk Management Guidelines, very clear on some things like production, dev UIT to production access and some other aspects of this as well. There are white papers on these at ssh.com if you need more information. FERC, NERC, critical infrastructure protection rules, again require controlling who can configure the critical infrastructure, obviously. If you don't know who can configure your power lines and switching systems, how could you have them secure? HIPAA, of course, requires controlling access to healthcare data. That's the law. Sarbanes-Oxley law, again, requires controlling who can access a public company's financial data. Again, pretty obvious if you want to protect insider information. Generally, these standards are technology agnostic, but it's about access, about who can access what. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is what needs to be done to bring this under control. And the core of it is controlling who can access what and properly terminating access when needed. And then what's required to make that happen? Well, first of all, there should be a provisioning process. Granting access to somebody or something should be a church decision, not something done by somebody whenever it's convenient. It should be a decision, it should be documented, the reason should be auditable, because how can you otherwise identify backdoors if you don't know which ones are legitimate? I know well, we have a customer who had a 15-person team doing nothing but dedicated team doing SSH key setups. Another customer, a bank, said that they have 200 sysadmins who, as part of their job, install SSH keys. And they estimate was that they spend 10% of their time doing it. So the cost of doing it manually can be significant. Errors can be significant. You need to continuously monitor these keys, monitor access, monitor which keys are no longer being used. I'll go in detail to all of this on the following slides. And then there's the existing legacy. Now, if you've got hundreds of thousands, even tens of thousands of keys, millions of keys, it is not trivial to go over all of those keys, decide which of them are legitimate, who should take responsibility for them, which application team is responsible for them. At the bank where we've been doing remediation project, one of the problems is they don't know what application team owns each account. So when we have a key leading to a service account, it's even hard to find out what team owns that account. And this is often where most of the cost is. You cannot just go and remove these keys because the bank would close its doors. So it's a complex process. In provisioning, so you have to enforce approvals with the objective of access being on a need basis and auditable, documented, recorded somewhere. Sometimes you need to revalidate the need for access, say, every year or something. Lock down the keys, basically move the authorized keys to root-owned locations. If you don't do that, anybody can add keys to their account. So let's say an Oracle administrator goes on summer vacation and gives the guy next desk keys to access the database in case something goes wrong, and those keys are never removed. Again, if most policies don't allow people to delegate their privileges to whomever they wish. And of course, this makes it very, if you don't lock down the keys, it's very easy to bypass privilege access management by just the first time you log in, leave your key behind, and then you never need to go through the privilege access management system again. Automate the provisioning of approval requests. This is about cost, eliminating the 15-person team or that 20 man years of work, millions of per year in savings potentially, and eliminate the manual errors that come with it. If you have to install a key on 5,000 machines, and I know people do this, if you do it manually, you're likely to make some errors. Say, forget the username when you are copying from root account to a service account, which might lead the key to accidentally being copied to the root account. Document the purpose and owner of each key so that it can be validated later. It can be audited, it can be terminated. And start enforcing command restrictions for any new keys. Command restrictions are important. They limit attack spread. It's much harder to spread the attack to another system if it's got a command restriction that only allows you to, let's say, fetch this report, run this script, than if you get shell access. Sometimes, though, you need keys without command restrictions, but those should be documented, and in my opinion, specially approved because they are a security risk. And those restrictions need to be effective, that they actually restrict something. I've also seen command restrictions that, well, don't really restrict anything. Even as a policy at the bank, when the policy says that every key must have a restriction, they essentially have a command restriction that doesn't really restrict anything. Very convenient. In continuous monitoring, you need to monitor both syslog and scan keys from the hosts. Key scanning allows you to detect if a root adds a key. Even if you've locked down keys, root can still add keys. You cannot really limit what root can do. So at least with this, we can detect when an unauthorized key is added. With syslog monitoring, we can do a number of things. Find out which keys are actually being used, where are they being used from. Even things like detect in real time if a key is used from an unauthorized location. So maybe somebody copied the private key. First time it happens, we catch it. We can monitor boundaries like dev and UAT to prod, or other boundaries that shouldn't be crossed or need special approval. Find trust relationships that cross such boundaries. Sometimes for reporting, sometimes for alerts. It's part of the monitoring. As a result of monitoring, say, let's say we've monitored the environment for 6 months. If some key has never been used, we can probably safely remove it. The objective here is to remove the number of keys in the environment so that there's less work to do manually. Facilitate audit of who can access what. People are going to be auditing this, at least in financials, in PCI environments, in the government, in public companies, at least for the financial data systems. Implement periodic key rotation. Most companies have never changed the SSH keys. They can be copied. Anybody who's ever had access to them could theoretically have a copy of them. Anybody who's ever had access to one of the backups or even decommissioned hardware. I have a friend who once bought a machine from the Air Force and was asked if he knows how to wipe it. And when he said yes, they gave the machine to him without wiping it first. He said it had some interesting crypto stuff on it. I don't know details. So anything that has a copy of the key is a potential source for leakage. They need to be changed periodically to enforce termination, to ensure that all access eventually gets terminated, even by copied keys. And of course, privileged access auditing needs to be implemented in a way that cannot be bypassed, that catches also key-based access. Problems in remediating legacy authorized keys, there are lots of them. And it can take hours to remediate one key. Just the bureaucratic approvals we've found can take 2 hours per key in some organizations, which of course is not a very effective process to do it, but that's real life today. Some of them are business critical. Actually, many of them are business critical. Thousands, tens of thousands of them may be business critical. Some are likely backdoors. We just don't know how many and which ones. We'll never know which ones were backdoors. And most organizations have no documentation of these keys. Some have Excel sheets that are totally out of date, not reliable. So as to remediating the old keys, my best understanding, and we've probably been doing this much more than any other company so far. My best understanding is that it's best to first discover the keys and monitor the keys, monitor the access, based on syslog data, for instance, to find keys that are not being used. Reduce the number of keys you have to actually check manually as much as possible. So those that are not used, out. Those that violate policy, say from interactive user service account, out. Those that are from development into production, out. Sometimes maybe you have to discuss with the people first, but out. Strict policy on those old keys. Reapprove them if you need to. That's a valid outcome. But anything that, by default, all such violating keys out. So you reduce the number of keys because the big cost is here. Because you have to identify a business purpose and, well, owners not strictly necessary, but you have to know which keys should be there, which keys need to be there, and remove the rest. And that is expensive because you typically have to identify the application, you have to go talk to the people. It's not a technical problem, it's a people problem. You have to go talk to the people. And that cannot really be automated. Yes, we can dig information about them, maybe even find out the scripts that are used there, the commands that are being used, what do they connect to. But in the end, it's a human decision. Is this valid or not? Is there a business purpose for this or not? And these approvals and purposes need to be recorded in a database so that they can be audited afterwards, so that we can compare scan results against the approvals and know that there are no extra keys. Or that we can terminate things properly. And the end result, we eliminate all keys for which there's no valid business purpose, even if they are used. If there's a backdoor key, it might be regularly used to go steal your data. Or let's say sometimes add a transaction when it's convenient for, let's say, faking something, adding evidence, stealing something, or whatever. And you have to rotate all keys. For this to work, you need to know where the keys are, what relationships are. And that's particularly tricky if there are connections to environments outside the managed environment. We can detect those external connections as well during the monitoring phase. But you have to be extra careful with those when you rotate, or otherwise you'll break that external access. Add command restrictions to the remaining keys wherever possible to limit attack spread. If you don't do that, you are still vulnerable to spreading the attack. And real life is companies, hackers get into organizations all the time. Viruses get into organizations all the time. And we expect the impact to be limited, that there's defense in depth, that even if it gets into one server, it's unlikely to spread quickly to a lot of other servers. That doesn't hold if there's key-based access from a lot of servers, especially servers that are likely to be compromised first, say some external-facing web servers, into something else. You certainly don't want SSH keys logging from DMZ to inside the network. That, luckily, most people have sort of addressed. Optionally, source restrictions, basically the from option in authorized keys file, it's a pain to manage by hand. It's probably too much pain to manage by hand, except for very small environments and the most critical systems. But it can be automated with the proper tools. And then it can make it much harder to exploit copied keys from systems from which they were supposed to be used. And there must always be a backup option. This is a process that's likely not to be foolproof. Even if you think some key is not needed, when you remove it, you may find that, oops, something critical depended on it. So you want to be able to back off to the previous state, or a state a while back, and then start looking at what actually caused the problem, because you might not even be able to identify which key in the last 2 weeks caused the problem. Some experience, for instance, at one bank, we have 10 people on site doing remediation projects. They've now been doing it for a year. My guess it's going to take at least a couple more years before they are done. They have, let's say, a relatively bad situation in their environment. The scope and complexity of the problem has surprised us. It's just the sheer number of logins, for instance, was at least 10 times, if not 100 times more per day than we expected. The number of keys found, we never expected to find over 1.5 million keys in the environment. And some of the complexities, like not knowing what application uses each service account, we never expected that. And many organizations don't really have that kind of data systematically gathered, which makes the remediation harder. The biggest cost by far is remediation, and especially figuring out which of the legacy keys are really needed. But I think it's a crucial part. Without it, you will never know who has access to your systems. Are there backdoors left by whomever? But it's going to take time, even with proper tools. Proper tools can help a lot. They can drop the cost to a fraction. Proper processes for it can, in a large organization, change millions. If you have to spend 2 hours per key on bureaucracy, it is expensive. But there are limits to what extent you can cut on that. But sometimes even a dedicated system to assist doing that effectively may be worthwhile for the duration of the project. In a big bank, it can be a multi-million project, multi-year project, with several people in-house and possibly outside doing it. But it must be done. And this basically represents my best understanding of what needs to be done. It's about access. It's not really a traditional key management problem. It's an access management problem. It's about access. Identity and access management cannot ignore 90% of credentials out there. I'll just mention that sometimes people say that, oh, we use PKI, we don't have the problem. Or we are moving to Kerberos, it will solve this problem. Not so simple. Sure, PKI gives you an expiration date, but it doesn't really solve the problem, especially if you are transitioning from a legacy environment. Kerberos is very helpful for a number of things, but it doesn't really solve the problem. It actually opens new cans of worms. For instance, OpenSSH by default, the single sign-on within Realm. So you might suddenly have a large number of implicit trust relationships between accounts, between machines, which is not necessarily a good thing for production servers. And it doesn't even allow you to restrict the command that you can run with that access. And you'd still have keytub files or something that's used to initialize the ticket for a service account or the client account. And that essentially is like the private key with similar security implications. It's just a different mechanism, but the implications are really the same, and you just transform to having to manage the keytub files. There are software tools available from a number of vendors. Some do only discovery. Some claim to do more than they can deliver. Most of the cost is in remediation. So I would emphasize what assistance can be obtained for the remediation part, because that's the expensive part. Ongoing provisioning costs can be very significant in the long term, even though in the short term it's maybe not the top priority, but in the long term that can be a big thing. We have some solutions. I'm not going to go into any bigger marketing pitch. Universal SSH Key Manager does key access management, essentially all of these steps, and it's being deployed at large organizations in large environments right now, and has been for the last year or so. CryptoAuditor is a privileged access management tool. The interesting thing is it can do transparent monitoring on the network, so it can catch automated connections, key-based connections. And admins don't need to change the tools they use. But there are also other tools available. Most organizations with large Unix and Linux environments, I believe, have a serious issue around this. Some may have had strict policies early on, but I've still run into one. Sometimes they think they don't have a problem. Looking deeper, most organizations seem to have issues. Many have actually some built-in in-house tools for things like provisioning, but it's not enough to solve the whole problem. And at the core of the problem is who can access what. The risks, the potential risks and the scope is generally not understood. The number of keys exceeds most people's expectations by, I'd say, orders of magnitude. You don't really have information security without knowing and controlling who can access your systems. It's at the heart of confidentiality, of integrity, and also of continued availability of those systems. And it's about access, not really cryptographic algorithms or key sizes. All keys ever created by SSH by default are not always perfect, but good enough. That's not the big vulnerability. Sure, you want to use big enough keys, but that's not the big problem. The big problem is all those thousands, even millions of legacy keys granting access to your servers that you don't know about or that haven't been audited, that haven't been controlled, not knowing who can access them. There's more information in the ITF draft at http://tools.ietf.org/id/draft-ylönen-sshkeybcp-01.txt. I think we have a few minutes for questions.
Good afternoon. Are there provisions in SSH similar to like certificate expirations in SSL? Is there any way to specify an expiration time within an SSH key?
For normal keys, no.